I really appreciate those who turned out in person. Thank you to those who are watching online as well. And, of course, I'd like to thank the Nussbaum family, who have been dedicating our Medical Ethics and Halacha Institute for the last several years, and really appreciate your support for the program. Our first of what we thought would be an annual event in bringing in a speaker for the community was in November 2019, when we had Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman. And at the time, I was very excited, and I said, we really have to bring Rabbi Dr. Jason Weiner here to the community. And I thought, well, next year we can do that. And, of course, you know, what happened happened. And it took us a while to get to this point. And when Rabbi Dr. Weiner let me know that he was planning on being in Toronto, I said, okay, this is it. Now we're going to take advantage of the opportunity. I first met Rabbi Weiner, met in quotes, in 2012, when he was kind enough to send copies of his guide to observance of Jewish law in a hospital for the members of our Beit Midrash. And I looked through my email archives and I found the exchanges that we had about his writing, which has been published, and my writing, which has not been published yet, and about various issues in medical halacha and medical ethics. And there's a kind of surprise to realize that the Zoom that we a couple of weeks ago was the first time we had actually ever spoken. And this is what technology is today. But throughout all of the different dialogues that we had about medical halacha, about medical ethics, Rabbi Weiner has stood out as a scholar of medical halacha and medical ethics, as a skilled organizer and presenter of information, and a true anav, and a sweet neshama, with remarkable patience and a willingness to give his time and energy for people he doesn't necessarily know. In fact, after we announced the program, I heard from multiple people who know him, you know, for his chesed that he's performed for them. I'm very excited that we're now able to have him here with us in person. A technical note for the doctors who wish to have credit for the program this evening. So those in the room, please make sure that you sign in on the sign-in sheets in the back that are next to the source sheets. For those online, I'm told that you can get credit for watching the live stream, much to my chagrin, but it's true. Send me an email to let me know that you're watching. If you send me the email between now and the next 10 minutes or so, then we'll know that you were actually watching the live stream, and we can certify that to the University of Toronto and the College of Physicians and Surgeons and all of those who care. So send me the email at torchiner@torontotorah.com, and that way we will be able to furnish you with a letter. Just to provide a little bit of background for those who did not read the emails that I sent out about the program this evening, Rabbi Dr. Jason Weiner, BCC, which does not mean blind CC, right? Okay. Serves as the senior rabbi and director of the spiritual care department at Cedars-Sinai, Los Angeles, where he is responsible for the chaplaincy team and all aspects of spiritual care throughout the health system. Rabbi Weiner previously served as the assistant rabbi at Young Israel of Century City. He has earned two rabbinic ordinations as well as a doctorate in clinical bioethics from Loyola University Chicago, where he also earned a master's in bioethics and health policy in addition to a master's in Jewish history from Yeshiva University. Rabbi Weiner has completed 4 units of clinical pastoral education. He's a board-certified chaplain through Neshama, the Association of Jewish Chaplains. He sits on the association's board. He's a member of the executive committee of the Cedars-Sinai Bioethics Committee. He is past president of the Southern California Board of Rabbis. He's been honored with rabbinic leadership awards from the Orthodox Union and Chai Lifeline. He is also the rabbi of Knesset Israel Synagogue of Beverlywood, and he frequently serves as scholar in residence at conferences and synagogues throughout, it says here, the nation, but I think it's North America now, on topics related to Jewish medical ethics, pastoral care, health and wellness, and he teaches hands-on Jewish medical ethics in the hospital and to numerous Jewish high school, medical ethics in the hospital to numerous Jewish high schools in Los Angeles. He is the author of The Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making. There are copies in the back. And Guide to Observance of Jewish Law in a Hospital. He has published more than 40 scholarly articles and book chapters, as well as several popular pieces. And with that, my job here is done. Please, Rabbi Dr. Weiner.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you very much, and a huge thank you to the Nussbaum family. Your your name precedes you very much. I've heard about you for years in the context of medical ethics, of kindness, of giving, of Torah, and it's really quite an honor to be able to be here in a lecture with your name on it, and thank you so much for having me. The reason why, you know, your name, I've heard about you from Los Angeles, is really, at least for me, thanks to Rabbi Torshiner. You know, Torah today is so, it's so open to anyone who can find great Torah, it's available. And as Rabbi Torshiner mentioned, we had not mentioned in person, but I've been listening to his shiurim, his classes, for years. Because when I got into medical ethics, I started searching around just for the best material. And quickly I realized that I was finding the best material in Rabbi Torshiner's lectures. I was just blown away. And also I realized from the of his lectures that this is someone who really respects his audience. Because the level of research and preparation he puts into these classes, I realized this is someone who really cares and really cares about the people he is working with. And his scholarship so profound. He mentioned my book is kind. He's quoted a number of times. I don't know if he knows that. A number of times, if you look in the footnotes, you'll find Rabbi Torshiner there quite a few times. So thank you to the Nussbaums, to Rabbi Torshiner, to all of you. It's great to be in Toronto. My first time in my life in Toronto. It's great. It's cold, but it's really, really wonderful. It's different than LA. I'm you know, I live my whole life in Los Angeles. And the hospital I work at is Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. I think some of you had told me that you've been there. You know, the culture in LA is a little bit different. There's a certain culture in Los Angeles. I'll give you an example. Our hospital is on the corner. This is not a joke. We are located on the corner of George Burns Drive and Gracie Allen Street. That's really, we're on the corner of George Burns and Gracie Allen. There's the Steven Spielberg building right there, the Barbra Streisand Pavilion. My office is in the Max Factor Tower. Our cafeteria is the Ray Charles Cafeteria. And, you know, so there's a Hollywood theme a little bit. And also, you know, image is very important in Los Angeles. And we have a marketing department that's very strict about how we promote ourselves. And one of their rules is that we are not allowed to use acronyms. Everything must be spelled out in full. For some reason, they think that that's more professional. So a couple of years ago, on Pesach, we make, you know, menus for all the patients. We have a kosher kitchen, and we have kosher, like, Pesach food. And I wanted to make sure everyone knows the food is kosher. So I put in big letters on the bottom of the menu, all food under the strict rabbinic supervision of the RCC. In LA, the RCC, Rabbinic Council of California, is like the gold standard of kashrut. And I knew everyone will know what that means. But they didn't remind me that they don't allow acronyms. They don't want RCC. But no one checked with me, what does RCC stand for? And I didn't know it would be an issue until Erev Pesach, it was a Shabbos that year, Friday afternoon, I get a call from a patient, Rabbi, I'm from out of town, but is this a joke here or something? What's going on with your hospital? What do you mean? He says, is the food kosher or not? I said, yeah, it's kosher. What's the problem? He says, maybe you should come up here and look at the menu. As I'm going up, I get another phone call, Rabbi, is it kosher? What kind of joke is this? I'm like, oh no, what happened? I get up to the patient's room, he shows me the menu, all food under the strict rabbinic supervision of Ray Charles. They thought the cafeteria, Ray Charles, so I had to explain to everyone the whole day, no, Ray Charles is not our mashgiach, the food is kosher. Of course, that same, year, it was Shabbat that night, and I thought, you know, we did a Seder, I thought it's too much to announce in the loudspeaker that there's Shabbat davening and a Seder. So I asked the people who run our, you know, our intercom system, let's cancel the Shabbat announcement. We'll just announce the Pesach Seder tonight. So I thought, it's great. I finally convinced everyone the food is kosher. Ray Charles is not the Mashgiach. Everything's going to be fine. I'm getting ready to go home for my own Seder. And an announcement comes out on the loudspeaker. Ladies and gentlemen, Shabbat is canceled. Shabbat is canceled. No. These people are not going to think it's funny this time. But no, we keep Shabbat there. We do have kosher food, but there's certain nuances of culture that sometimes make things interesting in different places. Those are some of the challenges we sometimes face at Cedars-Sinai. What I thought we would talk about is a topic that is actually maybe even more relevant than you might think, and I hopefully will bring that out. Technically, the topic is vaccination and risk-taking in Judaism. And this relates to so much in our lives. And so what I thought we would do is take this in three steps. So step number one, I want to talk a little bit and discuss. I really want to hear your feedback. Knowing from the esteem with which Rabbi Tershiner holds all of you, I am also personally very excited to hear your feedback and thoughts. So we'll start with the general category of an individual putting themselves in risk. How much risk should we put ourselves into? And I'll give some real-life examples and show why this is such a relevant and important question. We'll move from there to talking about not just risking ourselves in general, how much should I risk myself in our daily lives, but what about risking myself for the community, for more than one person, professionally? And then I want to try to build on that to try to talk about something that for me is still in the area of theory. I want to try out kind of a theory, something I've been thinking about on you and kind of hear your thoughts, and that is communal risk. Not just an individual risking themselves for the community, but how much risk should a community put itself into? And I'll try to explain as we get there and discuss. So the first section, and we have a source sheet here. I don't plan to read all these sources here, but I think a couple of them I want to highlight some really interesting ideas. And that is, I think what I'm going to share here is pretty standard, meaning if you'll ask 100 people to talk about, you know, risk in Judaism, a majority will probably quote these sources. So that's, I'm not going to go into too much depth with them, but I want to give this foundation because it's a crucial foundation. And that is that we know that there is a basic concept that, you know, and I put this here in the first step, in the first source here, which is the concept of lo tamod al dam riecha. We are not allowed to stand idly by when someone else is being injured. You know, it's kind of like, speaking of Hollywood, the last episode of Seinfeld. Seinfeld fans, remember the very last episode when they were on vacation in New England and someone's getting robbed and Kramer decides to take out his camera and film it. Instead of helping the guy, they laugh and they film it. And it turns out that that small town had a Good Samaritan law. A lo tamod al dam riecha law. You can't stand idly by. You have to actually help someone. And they actually end up going to jail because they didn't help the guy who was being robbed. So there is this concept, and we know that it obviously implies some risk, right? And that's what the Gemara here says. You know, how do we know if you see someone being robbed or you see someone drowning, you have to do something about it? Because the Torah says, lo tamod al dam riecha. But how much risk? I mean, if we're on an airplane, if you're a doctor, you're on an airplane, you're reading a novel, and someone is choking, and they say, is there a doctor in the plane? I don't think you can justify, you know, it's a really good novel. I can't put the novel down. I can't, I'm sorry, I want to help him, but it's so interesting. No, but let's say there is a raging river and you don't know how to swim and the person's being washed away in the river. Are you required to just jump into the river to try to save them? So obviously there's some kind of limit here. And the question is going to be how much. I mean, the truth is when the Rambam quotes this Gemara here in the first source here, he says, kol hayachol lahatzil. Anyone who is able to save a life. When the Meiri quotes this, he says, as long as it's not too dangerous. So there is some kind of a limit. And there's an interesting, a fascinating kind of debate that in the Talmud, in the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, it quotes a story, a very, very famous story, which is the story of two people walking in the desert. The two people walking in the desert, they only have one pitcher of water between them. Enough water in that pitcher to save one of their lives to be able to make it back to civilization, but not for both. And the Talmud says, famous story, that Ben Petura, who's only quoted this one time in the whole Shas, and I'll be happy to tell you a fascinating theory about who Ben Petura is, but not when it's being recorded, so afterwards, feel free to discuss it. So Ben Petura says, you can't watch someone else die. You gotta share it. So you'll both die, but you'll have to share it, and you'll both die. Ad Shabbat, Rabbi Akiva Vadarish, Rabbi Akiva comes and says, Chayecha Kodmin Lechaye Chavercha. Nope, your life comes first. I guess if we're using an airplane theme, just like on the airplane they tell you when the oxygen comes down, first save your life, then you could save other people's lives. But Rabbi Akiva has a fundamental principle in Judaism that goes throughout the Torah that when there's a situation of danger, our life comes first. It sounds, I don't know, it might sound selfish, but of how much good can you do for others if you don't survive yourself? So it seems to limit how much risk we take, right? We can risk for others, but not at the expense of our own lives. Our life comes first. But then, classically, so the next source that's often quoted in this regard, yes?
Can we choose to give up our lives if we know we're going to be
Right, excellent point. So when Rabbi Akiva said, your life comes first, does that mean you are required to save your life first? Or can you decide, no, I'm going to save someone else's life first, even though otherwise I have the right to save my life first? We're going to discuss that. That is a big debate. But I'm going to show you something that I think gives you the answer to your question. But that's a great question. There's a lot, by the way. There's chapters and chapters on this piece of Talmud. There's so much depth that we could pick out of it. And we're going to look at it. We're going to try to go a little bit deeper on it. But often seen as countering that source. So the Talmud Bavli implies your life comes first. But there is a great story in the Yerushalmi. The great story here, in fact, we're worth looking at inside. On the second to last verse there on page one, Rav Isi Itzdid Besasufa. There was a Rav Isi, a rabbi named Isi, and he got captured. He was captured by some kind of bandits, people who were not did not have his best interest at heart. And Rabbi Yonasan says, Yichruch Hameis Besadino. You might as well prepare the burial shrouds because there's no way to save him. I mean, he was captured by a rogue army that is too scary for us to go try to reason with, and his life is going to be over. That's what Rabbi Yonasan says. But Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, who had a history of known as being someone who was very brave and strong, he says, Ad ana katil v'ana mitkatil. I will either kill or be killed. I'm going to go izil umishazile bechayle. I'm going to go and fight. Chayle, like chayal. I'm going to go fight, and I'm going to get my friend back. It's like Fauda, right? He's going to go in there. I guess if we're also having the Hollywood theme, I know Fauda's not Hollywood, but so he's got the guts. He's going to go in there and risk his life. I thought you're not supposed to risk your life. He's going to go. He does it, and he goes. Azu faisun vivne le, and he goes and he's able to appease them and return Rav Isi. So this seems to imply that maybe one does have the right to risk themselves. It's not clear if this was an exception, if this is actually a matter of Jewish law, but it's an interesting story that seems to imply there is some room. But then we come to one of the most fascinating and I think relevant sources. You know, Rabbi Toshino mentioned I teach a class, a high school medical ethics class. So my challenge, what I always do with them, is I'll give a case and I'll say, think of just one source in the Torah that we have that could give us guidance on this case. And that's the challenge. That's what we debate. And it's always fun because so you would think, like, modern medicine is incredible. I don't have to tell you. You all know. The things we can do with modern medicine is amazing. They could not have imagined thousands of years ago what we could accomplish today. So how could we have Jewish medical ethics? Meaning, how could we have guidance from our tradition if the things we're doing today could not have been imagined in the past? So, amazingly, in most issues, we actually have really incredible sources within our tradition that give us very concrete guidance. So one of the things I often say to my students is, how about organ donation? Is there an obvious source somewhere in Torah literature to give us about the issue of donating an organ to another person? I mean, because you're not going to really have a direct source of someone in the Torah or in Shas, in the Talmud, actually donating a kidney to another person. They didn't have such technology until the 1950s. But there's a really interesting story that the Radvaz tells. The Radvaz was Reb David Ibn Zimri, 15th century Egypt. He was like the chief rabbi of Egypt. We have thousands of responses from him that people were writing to him from around the world. So he had a case where there was the following scenario. I mean, imagine what a horrible scenario. There were people who captured Jews, and I guess for fun or just out of anti-Semitism, it's not totally clear. They said, you know, we know you Jews care about each other. You're a community, and you sacrifice for each other. So we have this Jew here, and we are going to kill this Jew unless someone else from your community will come forward and let us chop off your arm. Should be easy, right? It's his life or your arm. What should come first? You would think, I mean, I really want my arm, but it's their life. So then again, this was 15th century Egypt. I mean, I don't know how clean this cut was going to be. I mean, there's clearly some significant risk there. And he debates it, goes back and forth. But let me just share with you the Radvaz's answer, because this starts to get to the real crux of the issue. So if you turn to page 2, he writes, and his response is so fascinating on so many levels, not just with medical ethics. His response is very unique. So on the top of page 2 there, he writes, Diksiv darcheya darche noam. The Torah's ways are ways of pleasantness. V'tzarich shemishpate torasenu yu maskimim el hasecha v'svara. It must be that the Torah has to be logical. The Torah has to be logical and make sense. V'eich yala adatenu shianiach adam l'samet einav. How could it be that we should require someone to blind themselves or lachtokat yado or raglo or cut off their leg or their arm k'deshelo yamitu et chavero so that their other person won't die? How can we believe that the Torah would require this of somebody? Hilkach eini roe tam ladin ze. I do not think that someone should be required to have their arm chopped off to save another life. However, midas chasidus v'ashrei chelko mishiyuchal la'amod bazeh. But if someone would do it, it would be an act of piety. So if someone would give their arm for another person's life, it would be very pious of them. How, on the other hand, v'im yesh safek sekanas nefashos, but if they would likely die as a result, we don't know how likely, but he implies from another response that more than 50% chance. There's a likelihood of death, then not only is it not praiseworthy, but in that case it is, hare ze chasid shote. That is now a pious fool. The classic case of pious fool is, you know, they say the story of a woman's drowning in the ocean, and there's this man that says, you know, I'm the lifeguard, I would save her, but I don't think it's appropriate, I don't want to, you know, I'm going to have to help her out of the water, it's not appropriate. So that's a pious fool, that's foolish. Come on, you got to save the life. So he says, if someone's going to give their life, so this is now considered a pious fool. But if they're just going to put themselves in danger, lose their arm, this could be not required, but very pious. So what comes out from this is that, and this is the way Rav Asher Weiss from who's the posting of Shaar Tzedek Medical Center in Yerushalayim, the way he sort of summarizes this is that, imagine you have like a seesaw. The more an act can help somebody, and the less dangerous it is, the more obligatory it becomes. So let's just say I use the example of organ donation, and we're honored to have Esther Dick from Renewal here with us tonight. Imagine we use the example of organ donation. So let's say if someone was going to donate bone marrow can really save someone's life. It's oftentimes hard to find a match, and it's not very risky to donate bone marrow. So it could be that if someone's a perfect match to save someone's life, it could be that it's even required for them to donate by Jewish law. But let's say something that would be extremely risky. I mean, in fact, let's just go to a real extreme. Donate your heart. What would happen if you were to donate your heart to somebody? You're dead, obviously, right? So that would be forbidden. So the safer it gets, and the more it helps someone, the more obligatory it becomes by Jewish law. And that's how the Radvaz summarizes, and this is the way that that many rabbis today try to sort of see the whole issue of risk. Risk is, we're not required ever to risk actually our lives for someone, but for lower risk, it's very pious and praiseworthy to do so. But if it's, if it would save someone's life and it's a low risk, it's considered to be extremely praiseworthy and maybe even obligatory by halacha. So that is sort of like the basic summary of the background before we get into like the real meat and potatoes of what I want to discuss with you. Let's just see one last source that summarizes this, and then I want to kind of go a different direction with you and see if you have any comments or questions. The Aruch HaShulchan summarizes this whole discussion we just had, and the way he summarizes it, I think, is very insightful. So he writes, this is the second source there on page 2. He says, Haposki meviu b'shem Yerushalmi, the chayav adam lahachnis etzatzmo, the suffix the kanekadesh lahatzil chaveru. The Yerushalmi that we saw implies that someone has to put themselves into danger to save somebody else. V'harishonim eshmitu zeh, but the Rishonim did not quote this. This has not become the halacha that we're supposed to risk our lives. Why? Mipnei shebashas shalana, because we saw the Bavli, that was Rabbi Akiva, in our shas writes, Mukach she'eno chayav lahachnis etzatzmo, that we're not required to put ourselves into danger. Mu, however, hakol lefi ha'inyan. It all depends on each case. V'yesh lishkol ha'inyan bepeles, and we have to carefully weigh every single case. V'lo lishmor et atzmo yoter midai. That's the main line I wanted to show you. And not to be overly cautious, meaning when it comes to saving a life, it's, yes, we should be careful, but maybe not overly cautious. I remember thinking about this story at the beginning of COVID. In our hospital, there was like this big debate, should chaplains, actually there wasn't a debate, there was no debate. We didn't get much guidance on should chaplains be seeing COVID patients. And we were concerned. We want to be there for them. They can't have any visitors, but obviously there's some risk. And one of the first patients that I went to was a Holocaust survivor, and I felt like I need to be there for him. His family was calling me that he was so lonely and that he was very, very thirsty. And I felt like, especially for a survivor, it could be so traumatic. So I went in his room, and he was begging me for some water. So I tapped on the window and asked the nurse if I could give him water, and she said yes. So I gave him water, but he was so thirsty that he like started gulping it. And he drank it too quickly, and he started coughing. And he coughed it all over me. And it was at the very beginning of the pandemic. And you know, obviously there was no treatment yet, and I was dripping with COVID water, and I was like davening to Hashem to save my life. And I was just like, how far should we be risking ourselves? Maybe this is too far. And I thought of this source. I thought, okay, we have to be careful. But maybe in this case, I mean, this person, and he didn't survive much longer. Thank God I was fine. So I thought, I don't know, maybe in retrospect, it was the right thing to help him because he was very lonely. But this is the debate. How far do we guard ourselves to help other people? So we see this as a foundation. But now I want to go start to broaden this. But any initial questions or comments? Okay, so let's expand this now a little bit. And now I'm going to tell you a story. Also, this is also a Cedar Sinai relevant story, but it's much broader. So here's a story. Now you have on your page there a picture. Do you have them in color? Oh, good. This on page 2 is Dr. Jesse Lazar. Dr. Jesse Lazar, how do I know who he was? Anyone ever heard of Dr. Jesse Lazar? Yeah? So here's how I heard of Dr. Jesse Lazar. Dr. Jesse Lazar was born in 1866 in Baltimore, Maryland. The reason I've heard of him is because at Cedar Sinai in Los Angeles, there is a huge mural in our main auditorium called the Jewish Contributions to Medicine. It's like 25 feet tall and about 100 feet long. And this artist that was commissioned in the 1980s created this mural, which is like the 40 greatest Jewish physicians of all time. It starts with Moses, actually. We consider him to be a physician. It starts with Moses holding the Nachash and Nechosheth, and it has Rambam, and it goes through to the modern era. And one of the people on that mural, and this picture is from that mural, one of the people on the mural is Dr. Jesse Lazar, who I was always curious. You know, I was curious at a certain point to learn who the different figures were, because not all of them are famous. I had never heard of him before. So I did some research. Here's the story of Dr. Lazar. So let's go back. Vaccination was mentioned as part of the topic, right? So when Jenner, you know, the inventor of the smallpox vaccine. So we know the history, right? Basically, smallpox was rampant, and he realized that the milkmen weren't getting smallpox. And he thought, why do they not get sick and everyone else does? And he thought, wait a second, they're near the cows. And the cows have the cowpox. It must be that there's some kind of, immunity that's happening. And so once he realized that, then he, so this is not like what we would do today, but then he took his gardener's 8-year-old son. Remember this story? He takes his gardener's 8-year-old son and he makes a gash on his arm and he rubs a little bit of cowpox on him to see if he'll become immune to smallpox. And it worked. So that was, I don't think they got IRB approval for that study, but this was how Jenner developed the smallpox vaccine. So obviously, on the one hand, it was an incredible discovery and innovation in medicine. On the other hand, some people were concerned, like, I don't know, should you have used your gardener's 8-year-old son for that? Like, is that ethically right? So there was lots of debates. Now, another thing happened. We know that military is often one of the main reasons for innovation in society, right? Governments have lots of money to spend on military, and there's things we can do to have advantages, and so they spend lots of money on the military, and those end up leading to innovations. So the 1898 Spanish-American War, 6,500 American soldiers died in the war, 5,500 from yellow fever. So obviously they realized, we can't win a war if all our soldiers are getting each other sick. So they needed to figure out how to prevent yellow fever. So they commissioned a yellow fever board. It was actually Walter Reed. You might have heard of Walter Reed commissioned the yellow fever board. And there was lots of different theories that they were funding research on trying to figure out how does yellow fever spread. And there was some theories that it spread through clothing. Maybe they could wash the clothing better. Some thought it just spreads in the air. Some thought from some insects. And this Dr. Jesse Lazar had a theory that it spreads through mosquitoes. He had this idea that there was something called a virus, and that it spreads through minuscule viruses, and that's how people are getting sick. Viruses had not been discovered yet. And so he's doing his research. And he went to Cuba to do the research. And if you look in the picture, you see him with some vials there and a tent behind him. What's the tent for? So what he would do is he would have mosquitoes bite someone with yellow fever. Then he would have someone else who was isolated, who was healthy, take the mosquito in one of these little tubes, bring it to the next tent, and have the other person be bit by that mosquito. If they now get sick, it's clear the mosquito transferred the virus. So he figured it out. This was how the virus was being spread. There was one problem. In medical ethics at that time, it was actually U.S. Surgeon General was named Steinberg. His last name was Steinberg. And there's a great anecdote that there was a book called, similar to that mural, there's a book called Jewish Contributions to Medicine. And when the book was at the publisher, he found out that in 1898, the U.S. Surgeon General's last name was Steinberg. And he thought, how did I not have him in my book? And then he did some research and he writes, I was relieved to discover he was not Jewish. Only relieved because he didn't want to have to rewrite the book. But anyways, this time they had this idea that, you know, people shouldn't be testing drugs on their 8-year-old gardener's sons. So they had this thing called the golden rule theory to experimentation, which was that a researcher, if they're going to try to research on others, they should research on themselves as well. It's not right to use other people as experiments if you won't do it to yourself. So Dr. Jesse Lazar in 1900 writes a letter to his wife in which he writes, and he has two children at home in Baltimore. He says, I believe I have discovered the cause of transmission. This is going to be a major discovery and we'll celebrate, you know, when I get home. He then goes into the tent, has himself bitten by the mosquito, and he gets yellow fever, and a few days later he dies. He became known as the martyr to medicine. And his researchers with him actually received a Congressional Medal of Honor for having discovered the first virus. But the question is, was that act of heroism, is that justifiable ethically? I mean, it was a major breakthrough. The truth is, at first, his wife didn't know that he did that to himself. Because for health insurance reasons, they didn't want to say what had happened. It was only after he died, after she died later, it came out that he had self-inflicted this. But anyways, is this justifiable? Yeah. That's a great point. We're going to talk about that, actually. Right. We do risk ourselves. I mean, there are times we risk ourselves. This was what it took. To move medicine forward and look at the amazing contributions that have happened as a result of these experiments. So let's go a little further and discuss more, but I you're on the right track. So if you turn the page to page 3, my next question is going to be, okay, like I said before, what sources do we have that could guide us in the Dr. Jesse Lazar, you know, debate? Was he right? First of all, we know he was Jewish. He is on the mural, but as far as we know, he's not observant. So, sorry? Okay, say more. Yeah. Good. The Haftorah of Metzora. You have the four lepers who they know that they're going to die, and they see the enemy camp, and they think they have lots of food out there, but if we go to the enemy camp, they're going to kill us. Then again, we're already dying. So they risked it and they lived. So, okay, that's an interesting source. We'll talk about that. One of the best sources, I think, might be also from the Tanakh, Esther. Rabbi Soloveitchik, recently, a couple years ago, Koren put out the Rabbi Soloveitchik Megillah. And, you know, one of the beautiful things about publishing and what they did was that there are certain stories and certain traditions we have in our history that are lost, that become lost if they don't get written down. And he tells, Rabbi Soloveitchik there has a story that it's another example of how much we lost in the Holocaust. Because there are traditions, there was memory that was snuffed out by the Holocaust. And if it would not have been a certain individuals remembering those stories and telling them and publishing them, we would have lost them for good. So Rabbi Soloveitchik in that Megillah writes that the whole purpose of the whole entire Megillah is one line. He says the halacha, the purpose of the whole Megillah's Esther is when Mordechai tries to convince Esther to go plead on the behalf of the Jewish people, the Achashverosh, plead on our behalf. Maybe it might be for this reason that you are in the kingdom, right? Maybe so, and if you don't do it, well, somehow else it will happen, but we're relying on you. So Esther is very nervous. She says, Somolai, fine, fast for me. I'm going in. I'm going to go plead our case to the king. V'chasher avadati, avadati. And if I die, I die. Rabbi Soloveitchik argues that point, we would not have known that point if it was not for the Megillah making that point. And that's why we have Megillah's Esther, he writes. So, and the truth is, you have this also in Rav Zilberstein. I just quoted a little piece here from Rav Zilberstein, who's the posek for Mayanei HaYeshua in Israel, and an important posek. And when he was asked this question, he also quotes Megillah's Esther as the source for this idea. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he tells this story, when he mentions this, he tells a story. This is what I was talking about before. He tells the following story. And tell me if you think this is a good source for our dilemma. He says, and this is what I meant by with the Holocaust, we lost so much. So, there was a rabbi named Ravman ben Ravman. That was his name. Obviously, his father died when his mother was pregnant. Ravman ben Ravman. And he was a rabbi of this shul. One day in the shul, there was a Jew who had left the community, and he wanted to hurt his former community. He left disgruntled. And he knew Hoshana Rabbah was coming up. Hoshana Rabbah, when we smash the rebels, right? And it could be a strange time if people who are not familiar with our customs walk into a shul and they see us smashing the rebels on the floor. So what this apostate Jew did was he went into a church in the middle of the night, took an icon. He then came early in the morning to the shul, opened the Aron Kodesh, put it in the Aron Kodesh, closed it up, and left. Then, when it got to davening, and he went to the government officials in Vilna, and he said, "You will never believe what the Jews are doing against us. Come with me. Come to the synagogue and watch this." So they walk into the synagogue, the government officials and this apostate Jew, and they see all the Jews smashing on the ground. And he says, "Look." He runs in, opens the Aron Kodesh, and there's an icon that had been stolen from the church. And he says, look at what these Jews are doing. They're trying to belittle our images. And the government officials are horrified. They round up everyone in the synagogue, and they take him to prison. And they say, you are all going to be punished with your lives. This rabbi, Rav Man, was not in that minyan. He hears later in the day that his whole shul was rounded up that day in Vilna. And he says, if I was there, I could have taken the blame. I could have said to them, blame me. Don't take my whole shul. I'm the rabbi. Just take me. Why would you take all of them? So he's horrified. He says, it's my fault. I wasn't in shul today. So he goes to the rabbi, another rabbi in the city. His name is Rabbi Shmuel Acharon. And he says to him, what do I do? I could go now to the police station and I could still tell them. I'm the rabbi. Let them go. They didn't know it was there. I put it there. And they'll believe me because I'm the rabbi. On the other hand, I'm totally free right now. I'm safe. I don't have to put myself in this danger, but I feel that I'm the only one who could do it. So he asked this Rabbi Shmuel Acharon, should I go do it? Should I go take the blame in the shul? What do you think he said? Yes? No? Shrugging the shoulders? Yes? Basically, that's the answer. His answer was, this is too hard of a question for me. He said, and Rav Soloveitchik says, the Vilna Gaon was still alive then. Rav Shmuel Aferman said, I'm going to go ask, don't do anything until I ask the Vilna Gaon. So he goes to ask him. Rav Man goes home. He can't sleep all night because he's still thinking, my whole congregation's in jail right now. I'm the only one that could save them. He's pacing in his study all night. And in the morning, first thing in the morning, he goes to Rav Shmuel Aferman's house, knocks on the door, and he says, don't ask the Vilna Gaon. I decided what's right. He says, no, let me ask him first. He says, no, I thought about it all night and I realized, Esther. This is the story of Esther. I'm going. He goes to the police station, and they agreed. They let the entire shul free, and they took him in prison. And they tortured him. They tortured him until Shavuos, 9 months, and they publicly executed him on Shavuos. How do we know the story? Rabbi Soloveitchik says he was once as a child in Vilna for Shavuos, and on Shavuos, every year, there was a Kel Mali Rachman that was recited for this Rav Man ben Rav Man. And he asked him on the story, and that's how you know the story. Which, by the way, this is just another side point, but we would have lost that whole story if he didn't tell it. He happened to be there that day, he happened to survive the Holocaust, thank God, and then he told the story. And now we know about it. And this Rav Man's memory can be kept alive. Was Rav Man right? Did he do the right thing? Because Rabbi Soloveitchik says, we don't know what the Vilna Gaon would have said. He never was asked. But Rabbi Soloveitchik says, I think he was right. I think he was right. He risked his life for his community, but that was the right thing. It was heroic, but that's the message we get from Esther. So do we have, what's the source? What do we have any precedent for that? So I want to suggest something, and I'll tell you why I was thinking about this so much, because this became relevant during COVID. In fact, I think I discussed this with Rabbi Tershiner at one point, if I'm not mistaken, and I'll tell you what it was. There's an amazing story in the Talmud. The Talmud doesn't even tell the whole story. It hints at it, and Rashi fills in the blanks. This is that on page 3 in the middle there. It says, Haruge Lod. Who were the Haruge Lod? Who died in Lod? So the Rashi says it was Lulinus Upapas. Lulinus and Papas. They were Jews. I know they're not Jewish names, but they were Roman. You know, some Jews have Roman and Greek names, like, I don't know, Jason, things like that. But they were Jews. So it says, Achim Shehargam Turinus HaRasha. Turinus, this Roman governor, killed these two brothers. Why did he kill the brothers? In Lurkia, Lod. That's how they said Lod. Lurkia. Kedamrina b'meseches Tainus, it says, Al Yedei Gezeres Shenigzera Al Yisrael Lashmid Al Shenimseis Bas HaMelech Haruga. They found the king's daughter killed in Judea. And they didn't know who did it. So, the chashdu es Yisrael aleha. And they assumed that a Jew must have killed her. V'amdu ha'achim halalu v'amru ma'alachem al Yisrael anu harganuha. Why do you blame the Jews? They wanted to kill all the Jews. They said, we did it. Take us instead. They were totally innocent. They didn't do it. But they pretended that they did it because they wanted to save the lives of their fellow Jews. So that seems to support all these sources that we've seen so far, right? Let me tell you a case of why I thought this was relevant in the last couple of years, and then I want to hear if you think that these sources accurately support this, or if you can think of any critique. So there... Sorry? Yeah. Yes. Also relevant, yes. There was the case, right, the grenade lands, the whole platoon's there, and the commander jumps on the grenade and takes the explosion, killing himself, but saving their lives. Similar scenario. Right, yes. Here was what came up, question. So I was asked by some researchers in our hospital. They didn't ask me because they were going to do whatever I said to do. They asked me because they were just curious, what does Judaism say? The question was challenge studies for vaccines. I mentioned vaccine a little bit. So challenge studies are, you know, as you know, right, there was a massive pandemic, and everyone was very anxious, like, how are we going to get out of this? So normally, to research a vaccine, the way you do it is you have to take, you know, thousands of people, half of them receive the vaccine, half of them receive a placebo, and then you have them go live their lives in society for 5 months, 6 months. And then you can see, did the ones who had the vaccine do better than those who had the placebo? And then you know if the vaccine worked. But that does take a lot of time, right? You have to give all these people those vaccines, and you have to then just wait. So There was another strategy called challenge studies. Challenge study was give them all the vaccine, and then expose them to COVID. Don't just say go live your life as normal, but actually be exposed to the virus. And this way we can come up with a solution much faster. We can see how effective they were. And the question was, from an ethical perspective, is this right or is this wrong? Do you think the sources that, the stories that I've just told you and the sources, do they provide guidance on that? Let's say you're the one who's asked. Will you enroll in a challenge study? Remember, this is also go back a year or two, right? And say, you know, there were limited treatments. And would you be willing for us to give you the vaccine and then expose you intentionally to COVID so that we can learn about the vaccines? Is this the right thing to do? Are these sources?
They were volunteers.
Yeah.
Just like the two people who were killed, they were volunteers.
But is it right to be that volunteer? Is it a good thing to become that volunteer? It definitely helps the community, right? That's true. It has a broader, greater good. Good.
Why is a barring challenge?
Okay.
It's a little bit of a different concept.
Yeah, say more.
When they were going to say, I'm going to put myself in the library, I know I'm going to say the community. Here, that's...
Oh, because it's experimental, we're not sure. The vaccine might not work, and therefore... Okay, good. Yes, okay. I hear. Okay. That's true. Right, good point. And, I mean, obviously, you can only have people sign up for the study who you know don't have many risk factors, they're under the careful guidance of their physician, so hopefully that reduces the risk as well. Yes?
On the other hand, though, we also talk to some people might say that they're actually higher because they're the only ones who can save the community, whereas with the challenge study, are you hired to actually participate in the challenge study? Most people wouldn't say that because there are other people who in theory could.
Right, very good. Right, as we said, chayecha kodmin, your life comes first. I mean, do you have to be the one? Right.
What if there are secondary benefits that you may get by participating in the study? So maybe someone who doesn't have any health care will get
Yeah. Right. Delicate question, because you don't want to coerce someone. I sometimes wonder, like the story with Jesse Lazar, you know, you see from his letter to his wife, he was very excited about that, about the acclaim he was going to receive. Was his decision-making clouded by the acclaim that he was about to receive? I mean, maybe he didn't make a decision that he would have made if someone told him, no one's going to ever know that you're the discoverer of this. You're not going to end up on a mural in Cedar Sinai. You know, maybe then he wouldn't have done it. But you're right, these are interesting, important things to think about. Yes?
So like how fast you want to resolve. The challenge study, you get an instrument, the other study,
right. Right, that's a primary issue, exactly. So Rav Kook actually has a different perspective on a lot of what we've just read. Fascinatingly, Rav Kook argues that a lot of these sources that I've just been quoting to you are not necessarily the best analogies for what we've been talking about. Because there's a big difference. Lulinus and Pappas, and also Esther, according to some interpretations. Esther is a little bit more of a stretch to say this, but they were going to die anyways. They were all going to die anyways. Whereas Rav Man, he had no risk. I mean, he was going to have to see his whole congregation killed. But he wasn't under risk. But when it came to Lulinus and Pappas, when it came to Esther, since they were going to die anyway, so if you tell somebody, here's your choice. Either everyone dies including you, or you die but you save everyone else's life and they can all live. So that's not quite as hard of a question, because it's like you can save lives and die, or you can die and not save lives. So maybe it's not a direct parallel. And that's what it seems to be, that Rav Kook seems to be not convinced in similar types of cases that this is the same. It might be similar with the grenade also. The grenade, the captain who jumps on the grenade, his choice was either they all die, including him, or he saves their lives and he dies. So, and of course, it's a great act of heroism. But can we apply it to cases where someone would not be at risk, that they should put themselves in risk in order to save other lives? Maybe these sources do not provide us with that type of a guidance. The thing is, to Rav Soloveitchik, it does. Because you see from the story of Rav Man in Vilna, he thinks it does apply, and he says this outright. So it's interesting, I guess you could see it as a kind of a machlokes between Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Kook. But this leads us now to the third category. And again, I'm going to open it up, and I want to hear your thoughts. But now let's go to one final area that I'm really excited to hear your thoughts on, because this is, I'm just still percolating in my brain this. But and this, I was really inspired to this by Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, because today was his yahrzeit, as you know, and I went through a phase when he died. I was a big fan of his, and when he died, first of all, I was obviously, I think many of us, there was kind of a communal shock and mourning, and I just went through a phase for about a year where I just read everything he wrote, and I loved it. I just fell in love with it. And he doesn't talk about medical ethics often. That's my field of interest. But one time I came across something he said about medical ethics, and I took it as a challenge, and it struck me what he wrote. And here's what he wrote. This was published in 2021, but it's a much older article, obviously, and published in tradition. He writes, the lack of appeal of Torah Umada in our time, right? Torah Umada, the debate between science, the interaction between science and Torah, the lack of appeal of Torah Umada in our time is a symptom of one of the most devastating effects of secularization, which is the privatization of religion. Judaism is experienced as a phenomenon of private life. There, in the home, school, and synagogue, it makes immediate sense. But we are far less sure as to what Judaism might mean in the public domain. That is why the one branch of Jewish ethics to have flourished in recent years is medical ethics. For most medical questions involve private decisions between patient and doctor. But on public questions, the discussion has been meager. And I took this as a challenge. Like, Rabbi Sacks was lamenting that in Jewish medical ethics, especially outside of Israel, right? Israel is a little bit different because they have a society to run. But still, even in Israel, there is this challenge in a certain way. But especially outside of Israel, we often think, okay, I need to know, you know, if what I'm going to talk about with my doctor. I need to know about my own risk. But in what ways am I thinking about how does Judaism inform public life? And, you know, this is especially true in the United States. I don't know about Canada, but I assume so. The Catholic Church, as an example, is very involved in the public debates and public discussion. They really care about what the government does. And sometimes I think, why don't we should care too. If we believe our values are important values, divine values, if they could have a good influence on the world, shouldn't we also, I'm not saying we should be trying to make people observe Jewish law. I'm not saying we should impose halakha on the masses. I'm just saying, shouldn't Jewish values also have a seat at the table to inform the discussion about what's happening? And so I want to take you on a little bit of a tour of a fascinating quandary. And based on that, share with you a principle. Because one of the biggest debates in public health, and I know some of you here, I think, have a lot more experience than me with this, but one of the biggest debates, and we've been talking about, you know, we mentioned vaccines and things like that, is, the right to try experimental new therapies and the goals and the values of caution, ensuring robust data collection, safety, efficacy, you know, should we be very careful and not be so forthcoming with letting people try new interventions or therapies, or should we be letting people try? I mean, we believe in innovation. So what comes first? The desire for innovation or a desire for caution? This is a big debate, right, in medicine today. And I believe Judaism has something to say about this, like it does everything, and I want to share with you my theory for what it says about it. Because it's not, many people could disagree with me, but let's take a look, and I'll just go to the middle of the page four. What I have for you on the top of the page, I put 1961, 2017. That's just to show an example of how attitudes towards organ donation, kidney donation in halacha have changed from kind of lukewarm support and concern to enthusiastic support. And that has changed in the years since organ donation has become a safe option. But the example I want to go through with you for a minute, because it's so fascinating, is IVF, in vitro fertilization. That the first IVF, anyone know the year? Close. 78. The only reason I remember is because I was born in 78, so I always remember that. So 78 was the first IVF baby. And rabbis start talking about it right away. In 1991, Rav Moshe Sternbach is the Gaivit of the Eda Haredis, the I guess you'd call it ultra-Orthodox rabbinic group in Israel, though he was in South Africa. So his first response on the topic, remember, IVF starts in 1978, so 1991, you know, 13 years later, approximately, he writes as follows. Ve'roi le'esor ha'davar. This should be forbidden, right? He believes, as a matter of halacha, that IVF is problematic, okay? 6 years later, 1997, look at the bottom of the page. He writes, actually, speaking of the non-Jewish world, he says, Afilu michochme umos ha'olam yeshnam shemishabchim osanu alkach she'anu omdim ala mishmar. Many non-Jews praise the Jews that we don't allow IVF. And they say, you know, those Jews are right. It's smart not to just be engaged in these experimental, you know, treatments that who knows what's going to happen with them. And then he writes in the next, at the very last line there, Ulechein ani nimna lahatir. Therefore, I do not permit this. Ukvar horakein hagon bal akilas Yaakov. And that's why also the Stipler Gon, the Kilas Yaakov, also did not allow IVF. By the way, one summer, I spent the summer in Israel to see their healthcare system. I spent a few days at Maaneh Yeshua in Bnei Brak. This is a Haredi hospital, ultra-Orthodox hospital. As an example, what does it mean, ultra-Orthodox hospital? Everything there goes through the rabbis. The rabbis are in charge. I think I went there because I just wanted to see, like, what's the difference between being a rabbi at Cedar Sinai and Maaneh Yeshua. It's different. So, so you want to know how different? I was with the rabbi the whole day, Rav Hoffner. He's amazing. So, he's getting emergency calls all day. The emergency room's calling him. The operating room's calling him. One call we got was from the security booth outside. He was like, oh, we have to go to the security booth. So I'm thinking to myself, what Shaila, why does the rabbi have to be consulted at the security booth? So we show up at the security booth, and there's a woman there crying, and these big security guards, and they tell the rabbi, she's bringing in food from her home. And she's crying, my daughter is sick here, she only eats my cooking. And they're saying, and the security guards are saying, our job here is to prevent any food that's not under our hashkacha from coming into this hospital. Not guns, not bombs, not food that's not under their hashkacha. That's what they're concerned about. And the rabbi had to say, okay, you know what? Did you bring your own plates and forks? Yes, I did. Okay, if you make sure this doesn't go anywhere near our, you know, our plates and forks, I will let you bring it in just this one time. Okay, guards, you can let her in. And that was the rabbi's job. So one thing he showed me there was that they actually started a fertility clinic at Maaneh Yeshua, and it lasted one day. It lasted for one day until it was announced. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky, the recent, you know, Gadol Hador who died, when he heard about it, he said, we cannot have a fertility clinic in Bnei Brak. My father, the Kilas Yaakov, was opposed to this. He says, I'm not saying fertility treatments are forbidden, but let them go to Tel HaShomer. Let them go to Tel Aviv. Why does it have to be in our hospital? That was what he said. Okay, I'm going to come back to this, because if this bothers you, don't go, don't leave now. So anyways, that was what the Stipler said, and we're talking about 1997. Okay, let's turn the page now to page 5. 2002. So now that's fast forward 5 more years. This time, Rav Sternbach writes, Ein ani omer bazel lo iser velo heter. Does that sound a little bit different than what he said before? First he said, roi lesor, this must be forbidden. Then he said, I don't allow it, I don't forbid it. Now he's saying, I'm not saying it's forbidden, I'm not saying it's allowed. He's kind of wish-washy on it a little bit. Okay, let's go forward now to 2009. 2009 he says there, the emes, the truth is, shlo hetarti velo esarti. I didn't forbid it. And then he goes, Ein ani matir ach gam lo oseh. I don't allow it, and I don't permit it. Okay? 2 years later, just 2 years, you see things speeding up, right? 2011, look what he writes. And this one, I'll read the whole thing, this little paragraph. He says, Acharei ra'osi sha'adavar hispashek. Now that I see that IVF, this fertility treatment, is spreading, people are using it. And I see thousands, maybe thousands and thousands of people are using this to get pregnant. Shaniti dati. I changed my mind. By the way, that's a sign of a great person also, right? To admit. He says, I changed my mind. I changed my mind. V'yesh lomar shemash Rabbeinu Kinas Yaakov tzak neged arotzim lasos kein, and maybe even the stipler, who is so opposed to it, I think even he, v'amar shezeh iser gamar, he said it was totally forbidden, hainu bizmano, that was in his time. She'ibur al yedei hamifchana haya davar nadir. It was very rare then. V'yazeh kebederech nes. It was like a miracle in those days. And so to him, at that time, it was considered inappropriate. So he said it's forbidden. But now, it's become standard. And now we see many fine Jews who cannot have children naturally, but only through fertility treatments. Thank God, hatzlichu la'olid banim uvanos, and they've had the opportunity to have children, ein ze pritzus. This is no longer improper, umutar la'soskein. And it's allowed. But not only is it allowed, remember, this is someone who said it was forbidden in 1991. Look at the last line. Ulanios daiti, nirisha zehu chiyuv. It is obligatory. Lemi she'enu yachol la'olid b'tzura tivit, shishtada la'olid al-yidei nifchana. It is now something that must be done by someone who has no other choice of having children. So the same person who in 1991 said that this is forbidden says in 2011 that it is obligatory. That is quite something, no? What happened? What happened? How did it go? How did the same act go from being forbidden to being obligatory? And not in that much time. I mean, That's not a huge span of years. 1991 to 2011. So, yes.
He didn't change his mind on the last day.
Okay.
He changed his mind because everybody was doing it.
Yes. Yes, good.
And with the known risks or lack of risk and successes, I think that also changes how you interpret.
Very good. Yes. At first, he had a lot of concerns. You know, are people going to? Are there going to be mix-ups? Are the kids going to be healthy? Is this going to ruin the family structure? He had all these, you know, various concerns. It's meta halacha. It's just he just feels that you know it shouldn't be done. But right, there wasn't a very specific like. Pasuk in the Torah that's being violated here. That's true. Right. That's true. It's a number of concerns, but not a specific halacha. Right.
Well, the point is, there's a whole cohort of people over a 20-year period who took risks, who maybe went against what the rabbi was saying, if they, any of them cared about it.
Yes.
And built the body of evidence.
Right.
Ultimately changed.
Right.
My only question is, so I agree with what Brian said, my only question is, why should a leader speak for the entire people and say, this is forbidden? It's different to say, look, I've got concerns, I've got caution, but to say, it's absolutely forbidden. Isn't that a discussion that should take place with the expert in the field, like the healthcare professional?
Well, yeah. First of all, we actually know that he did consult with people. I mean, he writes us if you read the whole tshuva. And I actually asked him about this once myself, and he told me he's consulting with the experts at Shari Tzedek in different places. So, I mean, there's that. You ask a good question, I mean, but if you take the assumption that it was his place to kind of tell everyone what to do. And I'm going to try to start thinking about this from like more governmental, societal perspective. Like, we do look to experts. Of course, we look to medical experts. But is there not a role for also values in the whole, in the discussion, right? Of course, we need the medical input. But from a value perspective, he's saying this. He thought at first that it should be forbidden, and he changed. He changed his view. Evidence-based halakha. I love it. Yes.
I'm going to present a cynical view. During the French Revolution, there was a leader who said, I am the leader of the French Revolution. I must find out where the people are going so I can lead them.
Right. Yes. I thought about that as well. Is he leading, or is he just kind of figuring out what's the popular thing to say? Is he just following what people are doing? That's a good question. It's a good question. It depends on, I guess it depends on how you look at it. And maybe there's a little bit of both. So the way I discovered this, I didn't happen to notice this change. There is a great person in LA that I'm very friendly with named Tzvika Reisman, who writes books about this topic, and he noticed it. And he happens to be very close with a number of these rabbis. He noticed this pattern, and he asked some great rabbis around the world, and he pointed this out to, there's a rabbi Mendel Shafran in Bnei Brak, who's known as being a big expert in these fields. And he asked him, what happened? How do you explain this? And he gave more the evidence-based halacha answer. This is the bottom. I'm not going to read it all inside because I don't want to use up all of our time on this to have discussion. But this is what he says here in number 5, and I'm in the bottom of page 5, which is that Mendel Shafran explained to him that the way halacha works, the way change works, is that we have to be careful when things are new. When something's new, there's a high burden of proof. We want to be able to see that it is actually safe and effective. But the challenge is not to just say everything new is forbidden, everything that's risky is problematic, to actually be willing to say, I'm willing to be convinced, though, that it is good. So you could, to give an extreme example, let's say, embryonic stem cell research. The Catholic Church sees that as being intrinsically morally problematic. It's not going to change. That is a form of abortion. It cannot, it's forbidden. But can we see things as, is there a middle view where we say, everything doesn't have to be permissible right away, but it doesn't have to always stay forbidden? In other words, do we say yes to new innovations? Do we say no? Or can we say yes, but maybe not yet? Meaning we have to go through the proper process. And maybe this is a sort of middle, not everyone agrees with this kind of approach. You know, there's people who take a much more innovative centric approach and argue, if you slow down research, what about all the people that die while they're waiting? What about all the people that wanted to have children in the meantime that didn't have children? From 1991 to 2011, there's a lot of people that he probably told not to have children. They didn't. Maybe you could say they waited too long. It's too slow. On the other hand, we know that there are times, for example, in cancer research, I was just talking to someone at my hospital about this, how sometimes you have drugs that that are still only in phase 1 studies. They're not clear yet how effective they'll be, and people are petitioning for a right to try, compassionate use, and oftentimes when they are allowed, let's say they're allowed and then not effective. What happens to the trial that was going to happen in phase 2, phase 3, when all of a sudden it was allowed and people got out of the trial, so they said, I want to try this? Or what about the other drugs that were making their way through the system, and now they found out something else was approved? Okay, I guess this isn't going to make it. So sometimes by being too innovative, we can slow down innovation in other ways, and maybe in the long term, less people get helped. Like, maybe it's worthwhile that we got to a point today where these great rabbis encourage IVF. Maybe it was worth it for them to go through a few years of prohibiting it. There's also another issue. Because, right? Yeah. Yeah. I just find it fascinating that in a 20-year period, in the same person, and it changed to extreme, from forbidden to required, in the same person in 20 years, I just find it a fascinating case study. Well, that could be another example, right? Yes, right. Right, so that could be another example, right? Yes, there are examples of this. Right, I've heard that.
So he said he never changed himself. It means that ultimately the Torah is there. I think the evidence is what changed, and that's why he can't.
Right. The mitzvah changes, not the psalm, right? The halacha stays the same, but the reality around us is constantly in motion. It's dynamic, right?
I was going to mention the case of the note of the Yehuda mentioned the time where he forbade an honesty.
Right.
Because there was no proof that somebody else could be saved.
Right.
But once you could prove that there are cases where people could be saved, the situation changed.
Right, especially with modern communication, that totally changes the. Yeah. So now, one another question you could ask me, the question I'm asking myself on behalf of you, is, okay, so now I'm saying that we should be cautious. I'm advocating for a middle approach, which is, we believe in innovation in medicine and science and technology, but cautiously. First, we want to see it's safe, it's effective, it's properly studied, and we do move forward, but we move forward carefully, and there's a burden of proof. First, before everything just becomes, allowed. So if you say that, well, what about what I was just talking about, COVID vaccines? COVID vaccines, myself and many of us, I think that we're encouraging them very early in the, we were really trying to get them out there, right? We had a pandemic. So what about that? Was that, were we cautious enough? So there is I want to share one more source, and this came up in the beginning. So, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a fascinating little piece where he talks about the concept of Milchemes Mitzvah. Milchemes Mitzvah is an obligatory war. Some wars are obligatory, right? We don't love war, but sometimes you have to have war. Yeah, sometimes it's Milchemes Rishus, sometimes it's obligatory. And there could be things in society, even so much as just, wild lions and bears running through the city, that you could actually consider as a sort of Milchemes Mitzvah, that the society has to protect itself. So he writes here, and I'm sorry it's not underlined, but if you go just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines from the bottom, he says, Efshar degam milchama neged machalot ha'oravos. It could be that wars against diseases, that risk l'chai adam havenami ke'ein milchamet mitzvah. It could be that illnesses could sometimes come into the category of a battle, of a war. Vim hainu zochim sha'kol yaseh al-pi das Torah. And if we would merit to the time that I'm arguing, Rabbi Sachs wants us to be in certain ways, that we actually asked, I'm not saying that, this might be different because this is in Israel, but where we asked, what is the Torah, how would the Torah guide us in our decision making? So it could be that you'd come to a place where, she'al pi das Torah, efshar she'al beistin hayaroe betzorach shel nisayon trufot kemochemet mitzvah shel hatzalat nefashot. It could be that sometimes testing drugs is in the category of a Milchemes Mitzvah. It's like a war, and sometimes in war, you put yourself in higher risk. There's a higher risk threshold, and a higher expectations of us to manage how we deal with crisis. And so, even though I'm advocating here for a precautionary principle, there's times for precaution, there's times for risk. Yeah, I don't know if Rebbeim were consulted on a government policy level. I know that Rebbeim were very involved with leading us in the pandemic and guiding us, and their opinions were very clear and well publicized. I'm not sure that the State of Israel asked. Right. Right, I'm just not sure if that was because rabbis were encouraging. I don't think it was, but right. But that's interesting. Yes. I don't know. Yeah. That's a good question. Yeah. And by the way, Shari Tzedek Medical Center has a fertility clinic, an incredible fertility clinic. I spent time there as well. They have mashkichot. They have women there whose their full-time job is to oversee everything and make sure everything's happening safely. There's a rabbi who answers all the questions. They have all these different strategies there for privacy and keeping people's, sense of dignity. And it's really amazing. I saw a lot of interesting things when I was there. For example, just once, because I happened to witness this, we had a question where there was a woman who, and then we'll start to conclude. There was a woman who had five sons. She came in with her husband because her husband wanted more children. She was also happy to have more children, but only if it would be a girl. She could not handle any more boys. Five boys in her house, well, I guess six, including her husband, was enough for her. And so her husband said, yeah, let's go to this clinic. They can make sure we'll have a girl. So the only thing is that Shari Tzedek, it goes through the rabbi. You can ask, and they can tell you we can do it, but they say only if our rabbi agrees. I happened to be there that day when this happened. I mean, I'm sure it happened many days, but I happened to see it. And it was a Sephardi couple, so they asked Rav Avadya Yosef, can they intentionally have a girl through IVF? What do you think he said? No? Yes? He said yes. He said yes. He told them that they could. So I thought that was interesting. He didn't say that was the reason. The impression that I got was because for her mental health and, you know, for their shalom bias and their marriage. But I thought about that too, but he didn't say that. But so anyway, so now I just want to summarize, and then we just have a couple minutes if there's any other comments. And I want to read one last quote from Rabbi Sachs that kind of summarizes, I think, where I'm trying to go with all this. So basically, what we've said is that when it comes to individual risk, Judaism does expect us to help other people, to be giving, to put ourselves in some risk. That risk is limited because our life comes first, so to speak. We're not supposed to risk our lives. That would be considered a pious fool to just completely risk our lives. But Judaism also does not say there should be no risk. We are supposed to, you know, help other people. And even if that means we put ourselves at some risk, and I gave, like, one example is the beautiful mitzvah of organ donation. That is a great mitzvah. And so there is some expectation of some risk to help other people. We have an obligation of chesed, of helping other people out. This is called in medical ethics, you know, benevolence, helping others. Then we talked about risk for the community. And it seems like the bar might be even a little bit higher, that we're expected to risk ourselves even a little bit more for the community. It's one thing to risk myself for another person, but for the whole community, we have some great examples, and Queen Esther being our role model in particular, that to risk oneself for the whole community is especially a mitzvah, and that's not just in these, you know, crazy cases of, you know, like I told you about in Vilna, but it even came up, you could argue, during the pandemic with these challenge studies, you can think of, or you can imagine the case of the grenade in the war, you can imagine cases in our lives where we have to risk ourselves for the community. And then, as the final, I want to just kind of throw it out there as an argument that even when it comes to societal risk, our society, we have to think about how our society should express risk, that there is some room for some risk, and also caution, and trying to find the right balance between risk in society and expressing caution. And this leads to a quote from Rabbi Sachs's final book, although I think four books have come out since his final book, but his final book, Morality, which is really a special book, where he talks about moving our ideology from I to we. Not just thinking about ourselves all the time, but thinking about our community, thinking about others. And he just has a great quote there that I loved. He writes on the last page there, page 6, I call the move from we to I. He thinks that the problem in our society is that it's moving from we to I. We're supposed to move from I to we. Our society is moving from we to I. The I generation, right? So he calls this cultural climate change. But there's a difference between this and environmental climate change. For us to make a significant difference to environmental climate change, billions of people must change the ways they act. That's because the environment is global. But culture is more local, especially when it comes to the tone and tenor of our relationships. To begin to make a difference, all we need to do is to change ourselves, to act morally, to be concerned with the welfare of others, to be someone people trust, to give, to volunteer, to listen, to smile, to be sensitive, generous, caring. To do any of these things is to make an immediate difference, not only to our own life, but to those whose lives we touch. Morality is about each of us in our own sphere of interaction, taking responsibility. We don't have to wait for the world to change, for our lives to change. And this really is my main message tonight, which is that there is some risk inherent in life. And our society, our religion, expects of us, obviously, to be safe and to be careful, but also to be giving and to help others, and that often requires some risk. May Hashem protect us from horrible situations that our people have had to go through, but may Hashem also give us the courage and the strength to be able to rise to the occasion and be there for our community, hopefully in health and happiness for many, many years. So yeah, I think we have a couple of minutes. Yes. Yes.
Before going into this,
yes.
I'm reminded by the question of decision during pandemic,
yeah.
Versus the Hatzalah project during pandemic. The decision was, and it was posed, this question was posed that they must return, they must essentially incur some risk. But the Hatzalah person is not.
Yeah.
That was the side.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true in American bioethics as well. There's an expectation the more one has the skills and is in the position to help, that there's a higher expectation. There's actually an interesting story that Rav Zilberstein from Mayne Yeshua and Bnei Brak tells about the stipler. He says that someone once went to him and said, I have two choices in life, for whatever reason this were his choices. He said, I can go be a rabbi in a small town where my kids won't have any schools, any Jewish schools to go to. It'll be a hard Jewish life, but I've been offered a role as a rabbi there. Or I can stay here in this large Jewish community and be a doctor. And it's a great Jewish community. Which should I do? So the stipler in his answer, he warns him. And he says, if you stay and be a doctor, I'm just warning you now, your expectations will be much higher than if you're a rabbi. Rabbi has certain expectations, but the doctor, your expectations will be higher. You'll live in the community, so that'll be great. But once you have the training, there's more expected of you. You have to live up to those standards. So that's an example of, the more you're capable of doing, the more you're expected to do. And the more you're trained to do, the more you're expected to do.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. Miner. I really appreciate it. It was a joy to listen, and particularly some of the stories which I had not heard before, so including that stipler story, which I have to think about. But thank you.